Hello and welcome to Cranfield University. In this interview series, we explore the role of philosophy and humanities more broadly for management, engineering, but also for our everyday lives. I'm Andrei Pavlov and I'm Professor of Strategy and Performance here at the School of Management.
My name is Toby Thompson. I'm the Studio Director here at the Granville Turner Studios at Cranfield. My interest is in continental philosophy, particularly Heidegger and executive education.
And our guest today is Dr. Claire Benn. Assistant professor at the Leverhulme Center for the Future of Intelligence at the University of Cambridge. Claire, welcome. Welcome to Cranfield.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Claire, I have kind of a broad question for you. The motivation for all of this, for this entire interview series that Toby and I have, is to explore the practical value of philosophy, and especially how this could be taught to practitioners in professional schools. So I do it on the MBA program. Toby teaches it to our faculty across all of the disciplines. But I'm really intrigued in the program that you're running at Cambridge, the MPhil. Could you tell us a little bit more about how it came about and what's it about, and what do you do within that program?
So yes, I work at the Leverhulme Center for the Future of Intelligence here at the University of Cambridge, and we actually offer two master's programs. So we initially launched an MST in the ethics of AI, broadly speaking, and that's a 2 years part-time master's program for people who are currently working professionals in a variety of fields. And that's been running successfully for the last 2 years, whereupon we realized there was a real need for another additional program focused slightly more on research for people who often are coming out of their first degree. So this is the MPhil that I run in the ethics of artificial intelligence, data and algorithms. This is a 9-month course. It's partly taught. So we have several taught components to it and then extensive independent research parts as well.
And your students are working professionals as well?
No, so most of them have just come out of their first degree.
Right.
Some of them have had some time working in industry or policy or doing other kinds of study. And then they're here doing this now full time. Yeah, before they either go on to further research or back into their professional sphere.
And so what's the content of this MSc? And what are they after, do you think?
So in the MPhil then, we're bringing together students from a huge range of disciplines. So we have philosophers, my background is in philosophy, but we also have people from all sorts of arts, humanities, social science, as well as technical disciplines. We have some journalists, some lawyers, it's a really broad spectrum. And so one of the things we're really interested in doing is bringing them together to allowing them to develop a shared vocabulary, sharing the kinds of problems that each of their individual disciplines might have focused on, and then allowing them time to do both research intensive work where they can make a serious contribution to this field, but also explore beyond the discipline that they may have originated in to do really interesting work that kind of cuts across those disciplinary boundaries.
And so what are some of the questions that they're asking? What are some of the projects that they're doing?
I'm not sure I can comment on any specific projects, given that they're still underway, but lots of interest at the moment on LLMs in particular, given the rise of ChatGPT and especially the new developments in ChatGPT-4. But all sorts of questions from geopolitics, the role of technology and its use in education, deepfakes, foundational questions across the sciences and the arts and humanities, including some qualitative and quantitative work. A big branch of some of the work that gets done in my institute is also on narratives, like the use of stories and myths and narratives and metaphors to shape the way in which we understand and engage in the world. And so there's a big stream of my students who are interested in those kind of questions as well.
And you said, Claire, AI, it's really very easy to say, artificial intelligence. But you also talked about large language models. Is there a spectrum of what we're talking about here in terms of AI? Are we talking about equity trading algorithms? Are we talking about ChatGPT? What are we talking about?
So my MPhil covers a broad range, and I completely agree with you that it is very, very wide ranging in terms of what people mean when they use the term AI. That's why, in fact, the phrase AI data and algorithms was selected for the course, because sometimes it's not really about kind of any specialized AI. Sometimes it's just sophisticated statistical methods or, you know, large amounts of data that go on to inform certain kinds of decisions. Or algorithms in the more straightforward recipe sense, like old-fashioned AI rather than machine learning. So it does cover a really broad range, and they are importantly distinct, and yet somehow a lot of the issues that arise kind of draw them all back together, which is why I think it makes sense to look at these technologies holistically, even though their form and their applications are really, really wide-ranging.
Oh, go on. No. Actually, okay, you've asked a bunch of questions. I'm next.
Okay, yeah. He gets another question.
Trend. I mean, it's trendy. It's trendy. Last year it was metaverse. This year it's AI. You seem immune to that trendiness by the sound of it.
Yes, I am. I mean, my personal research is interested in current and emerging technology. So I want to look at the technologies we have right here, right now, the stuff that's actually up and running and being deployed, and the things that might arise in the near future. So I tend to stay away from questions about things like artificial general intelligence, though I have many colleagues who are very interested and doing lots of key work here, especially in our sister center, the Center for the Study of Existential Risk, where they look at things that are extremely high risk, including AGI, amongst others, which have a low probability of happening potentially, but given how risky they are, really need addressing now in advance rather than waiting for them to happen. But I think that it's easy to get distracted by certain forms of a technology. And instead, I think it's often beneficial to look at the capacities behind those technologies. What do they enable us to do? What kinds of actions are they enabling us to do? What kinds of resources and inputs do they require? And how do they reshape the way that we interact with each other and the world? And you can then see that, like, quite a few seem on the surface disparate technologies might have a lot of similarities between those. And we shouldn't get distracted by what's shiny and instead start thinking about those questions instead.
So presumably that's the value of looking at it from the philosophical viewpoint or from the philosophical perspective.
It's one of them, yeah.
Okay.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, philosophy as a discipline is often interested in getting to the foundations. Mm-hmm. And so not staying on the level of the appearance in the narrow sense, but instead wondering about more foundational questions that then you can start to see important similarities across technologies.
Can you talk more about the role of philosophy in these questions? I mean, why? So you're a philosopher and you're interested in the role of philosophy in technology as a researcher, but also, of course, you have a big component of that in the MPhil as well. So what is that role? Why? What do we gain by looking at technology from the philosophical perspective or angle?
I think it's tricky in part because it requires perhaps an account of what philosophy is. And
go for it.
As a philosopher, then giving definitions, we've seen how difficult that can be. But I think that there are two aspects to philosophy. One is that it's interested in certain kinds of questions. So things like epistemology and metaphysics and ontology and ethics often form the kind of core content of philosophy, but is also interested in specific kinds of skills when looking at those and using specific techniques to address them. And I think both the content that philosophy is interested in producing, but also the skills that we employ and the techniques that we use are often beneficial when looking at these areas. I mean, in some sense, I have an easy sell as an ethicist in particular, because I'm not just kind of, as a philosopher, I'm not interested in every kind of question. That's not my specialty, but I am particularly interested in questions of ethics, epistemology, and aesthetics. And we're seeing increasing acknowledgement that ethics plays a role in everything we do. And in that sense, then, it's easier to see the direct relevance of subfields of philosophy like ethics to all of these questions.
So my interest is on that equation of artificial intelligence, the intelligence side of it, Are you less interested then in quite what intelligence is, or the appearance of intelligence, or what intelligence counts for? Is that not your interest?
Personally, no. I leave that to excellent colleagues of mine who have specialized much more deeply in the philosophy of cognition, for example, and cognitive science. Yes, huge numbers of my colleagues here are doing phenomenal work on this, including a big stream on, it's called Kinds of Intelligence. And one of the projects there is looking at using cognitive science measures of animal intelligence and seeing whether we can create evaluations of artificial intelligence systems using those methods.
So, yeah. Bagsy, one quick one.
Yeah,
go for it. So philosophy of action, by the sound of it, is something that touches into what you're talking about, an intention and a kind of Anscombe type approach. Is that of interest to you too?
Well, I think that we can do a lot of really interesting and important work in the here and now without ascribing mental states to machines. So I think answering questions about those mental states can be really important. And it's questions are beginning to arise about machine consciousness, about machine rights, whether they can deceive, whether they can understand, and how many mental states you need to ascribe in order to start really comprehending what those claims mean, whether they're true, and the implications of those. But I think lots of the kind of basic machine ethics questions that we have so far left unanswered do not require us to really answer those questions at all. We can just say no, they don't have intentions of the right kind. They are not motivated in the cognitive sense, perhaps, that we are. Sure, they have things that they care about, they're trained in certain ways, they have rewards of a certain kind, they can be made sensitive to certain kinds of loss functions, whatever, but they're not cognitive in any meaningful sense right now, I don't believe, but I also don't think the work I do requires them to be.
So they haven't got desires, they haven't got a notion of the future for them, they don't have rights, would you agree with that?
In current form, I would say no. But like I said, one of the interesting things I think about some subsets of machine ethics questions is that we don't have to answer those questions to carry on thinking that they do act in the world, they do things, those actions are consequential and can be positively or negatively valenced, and that we want to constrain machine behavior in such a way that it produces better outcomes for us and for our environment. And that's enough, right? That's enough to be getting on with. There's enough problems there to keep me going for a lifetime.
To be getting on with, yes. I think it doesn't finish it, but yes.
I suppose the question I have is, I completely agree with this viewpoint, but wouldn't you need to have at least an implicit view of the nature of intelligence in order to then say, okay, so that's my view, and then I can move on to other questions? Or is it not relevant at all?
No, I don't think I do have to have an understanding of intelligence per se. Understanding what these machines do and what they're capable of doing is really important. But it depends whether you think that the idea of intelligence goes beyond that, whether it requires other kinds of specific cognitive states, or whether they need to be measurable on certain tasks that we think are important. That I'm not sure about, but an understanding of how these systems actually technically work and what they're in fact capable of, that is absolutely key.
So what would be some of the questions, some of the ethical questions that we could ask about this? Kind of leaving the question of intelligence and the nature of intelligence aside, what are the questions that we could ask about machines and interacting with machines now in their present state?
So some interesting questions that concern me are things like when it comes to LLMs, how does our interactions with them change the epistemological setting that we're in? Can they tell us untruths? Clearly, yes. How do we judge the capabilities that they have merely from interactions with them? What does this do to the knowledge environment that we're in? Obviously, there's lots of questions about this year in particular, when so many consequential political elections are underway, how these kinds of technologies are going to shape our environment from a knowledge perspective. And I'm also very interested in machine behavior. So are there constraints that we want to put in place? What kinds of constraints? What kind of ethical considerations can we and should we program into these machine systems so that they can interact in our world in a way that produces morally beneficial results?
The implication there being clear, for me at least, is that there's some notion of truth in the background here, and to how much are they mimicking truth, or how much are they revealing truth to us? Do you think truth is important?
Yeah, very much so. I think that when it comes to the kind of machine learning systems that we have now, what's particularly interesting about them from my perspective is that they have this ability to be part of an almost scientific method, or they can be used to reveal true things. So I think AlphaFold has been a really interesting one where it's revealed different structures that perhaps we weren't, but also could never be aware of by ourselves. Like, the value of machine learning is its ability to learn and therefore to teach us. And yet at the same time, it's not just in the business of discovering, but it's also in the business of communicating that to us. So it does not only reveal perhaps some true things, but it might also then not necessarily tell us true things. And we should be interested in both sides of that equation.
So in terms of hallucination, I'm just thinking on a negative and an extreme sense, you could say that ChatGPT-4 conceivably hallucinates. It comes up with stuff that isn't true. And then uncritically, you could then believe it to be the case because it's LLM. And it looks right. Is that something you can regulate against?
I think so. Hallucinations, I think, was word of the year last year, and it's been quite debatable about whether it's the most appropriate term to be used for LLMs. But what I think is more interesting than the fact that it tells us the wrong thing sometimes, right? So it's been well documented. That things like ChatGPT are really bad at quite very simple tasks. So if you, and it's got better at some things, so GPT-4 is definitely better at some things that it was bad at in GPT-3. But when I have tested GPT-4, things that a five-year-old could do, like how many times does the number 100 appear in this list of numbers, it will get wrong just over and over again. Like, even if you tell it it's wrong and ask it to correct, it will get them wrong. And you might say, well, you know, we should be worried about it telling us false things. But I think what's more concerning is the unpredictability of it telling us false things. So if it was consistently just bad at something, we would be able to adapt. But actually, it's really, really good at a whole bunch of tasks. And then you only have to change that very same task a tiny amount, and it will consistently get that wrong.
Claire, isn't that catastrophic?
Yes, I think it's one of the most problematic aspects about LLMs as they currently stand, is that it's very difficult to assess the kinds of capabilities that they have in a way where we can predict where they're going to be correct and where they're going to be incorrect.
So I build from that a lack of trust, no?
Well, I think we can trust it for a wide range of tasks where there is a high level of predictabilities, but I do think that it's problematic to rely on them too much. And we can see this in an array of domains. So one of the classic cases in which hallucinations have been occurring is actually in academic work, and the work of students in particular who've been using it, and the problem with having accurate citations.
Indeed.
And so, yeah, indeed. I wondered if you had come across this.
Absolutely.
Student. But we, its unpredictability in that domain is predictable. So we come back to the idea of, you know, the known knowns and the unknown knowns and so on and so forth. So our trust, though, should be limited, and we should remain skeptical in certain parts. But that doesn't mean that these systems aren't useful. I mean, it is a really interesting and important leap forward. And the kind of ways in which this can be employed in a variety of settings is itself worthy of exploration.
But doesn't that mean we need to generate or come up with a new level of suspicion? A new level of criticism.
What, on the part of humans?
Yeah.
I think we already are fostering that. I think, though, that the problem is that certain parts of society and academia are playing the role of being very skeptical, and certain parts, often people who are practitioners, who are engineers, computer scientists, and so on, can, in particular in a business setting where the priorities are different, not necessarily have enough skepticism.
Okay. Can I sort of get us back to the question of epistemology? I've got two two questions kind of leading off of that. One, I just have to ask you about your view on the Turing test. There is so much discussion at the moment about whether it's still a good test, whether there are machines that have passed it, whether we should keep using it. What's your view?
I think that Turing came up with it for a very specific purpose. And I actually think that, and of course I would say this because I'm a philosopher, but reflecting on its limitations is, I think, its main contribution. So it was interesting to note that some machines that had been put forward to pass the Turing test were failing because, for example, it answered difficult math questions too accurately or too quickly. Mm-hmm. And so you make it more likely to pass a Turing test and pass itself off as a human if it makes more mistakes or has more pauses, for example. And you think, well, surely if we're interested in intelligence, then really like that makes it a better machine. But that just shows the limits of the test. That, of course, we have to rely in part on how things appear to us. But we're still using a very, very human-centric understanding of capacity. And abilities and value that probably weren't the best place to start in the first place. So part of my work in ethics is exactly on the idea that when it comes to ethical behavior and ethical capacities, human beings are a really bad place to start for machines. Like, we're not necessarily very ethical ourselves in our actual behavior, but even when you focus on the things we think we ought to do rather than what we actually do, that's probably not the best place to start for machines either.
And we can't be relied on the truth either.
No.
We're terrible.
There's lots of questions about like whether we should hold human standards as this, by which to evaluate machine systems.
And if we're teaching, if we're teaching the LLMs and we're the ones that are modeling it for the computers, there's a tremendous amount of confirmation bias anyway. Surely it's just what we fancy, and we're partial.
Yep, LLMs like ChatGPT and others. Then their job is to essentially say something that probabilistically a human would say in response to that problem. Mm. Yeah, and are we really that, you know, is that the measure?
Fair enough.
what does management say about that?
So I suppose my other question, kind of leading off of the of our discussion of epistemology, is you mentioned that your work lies at the intersection of ethics, aesthetics, and epistemology. So how does aesthetics come into it?
I'm particularly interested in appearance. So acknowledging the fact that we can't necessarily get insights into every aspect of each other and machine systems. The fact when we acknowledge that, we realize that we're relying a lot on how things seem and appear to us. And we use that to make judgments about things like their epistemological state, other people's epistemological state, by which I mean simply what they know, what they don't know, but also what motivates them, what they value, and about what how they might behave in the future. And how we, that has huge influence on what they ought to do. But also we have to take into account that what we do and what we ought to do might well change depending on how things appear to us.
Which for me is addressing Kant's noumena, the stuff that you can't see, pun intended, because art allows you to engage with the surface qualities. So it sounds like when you said that the machine answers too quickly or too accurately, that's quite a mannered approach. If only you mannered it. You can't reach. There's something you can't reach here. There's something unattainable. Help me out here.
Well, it's true. I think it demonstrates the limitations of us, that we are always on the outside, that there is lots of things we cannot have direct access to. But this is not a new problem. So the problem of other minds has always been the fact that I can't have direct access to your personal, subjective, lived experience. And yet we get along very well often with each other and in the world, despite that. So the question is then, how can we do things like constrain ethically machine behavior while acknowledging that there are certain parts of that system that we are unable or unlikely to have access to as well? And so we can then focus instead on how that behavior is communicative. And that's like one of the focuses of my research.
You say it's not new, sorry.
Yeah.
Plato in Phaedrus has Socrates say that writing is very dangerous, can't be trusted because it's going to make sure the students can't remember things because you write it down. So writing is dangerous. It's untrustworthy. That's back in the 4th century before the Common Era. Nothing new there.
So almost all developments in technology have prompted anxiety about the elimination or reduction of certain human skills. And artificial intelligence has been no different. So there's an interesting line of research that's been done about this idea that the use of AI is going to lead to a reduction in certain human skills. But part of that discussion is, well, how bad is that? So most people might not know how to set up, use and operate a typewriter anymore. Most people don't know how to effectively wash their clothes by hand. And lots of people, myself included, are really bad at map reading. So if you tell me how to get somewhere by giving me actual directions or a physical map, not going to have a clue. But really the question is how tragic is that loss? So I once, in my MPhil, actually, I gave them a list of activities and said, how sad would you be if you just never did this again? And it was really divided, really divided. So some people are, champion orienteers or something, and thought map reading was really key to human existence. And most agreed that knowing how to wash your clothes by hand, they had happily never had any human ever do again. But it's an interesting question. How valuable are these skills?
Does the notion of progress come up there? That we are progressing. Look how we are progressing. We're so much better than we used to be.
Absolutely. This idea that we have progressed beyond hand washing clothes. It's all about being able to do new things, about replacing menial tasks often. But now we're entering into a situation where people are also very anxious about the reduction of intrinsic or instrumentally valuable things. So moral decision making is the classic example where we think that being the author of our own moral decisions is important, even if we are actually less good at doing it than, say, a machine system. It's not true right now, but suppose we had a system where we could automate it. Ask it any moral question, it will give you a more accurate answer than you will ever produce. Is it the case that you should just do whatever it says? Should we just defer in that instance? And arguably the answer is no, that autonomy matters, that the authorship over our actions matters, and that developing these skills themselves as a practice, but also having the expertise at the end or along the way, is itself meaningful and important.
Can I take us back to almost where we started this conversation? Because what we are talking about now is pretty fundamental, and some of these questions are quite abstract and quite deep. How do you get your students to engage with these questions then? People who are, as you said, their background in journalism or healthcare, or people who have maybe very little or no exposure to philosophy. How does it resonate with them? How do you get them to engage with us?
So one thing I think that's been interesting in the last 5 to 10 years, I think, is a real resurgence in the interest and importance of philosophy.
Yes,
and the
I'm glad you agree. I'm glad you agree.
I think there was a long period of time when I was doing a PhD, for example, where it really felt like maybe this was the end of the road for philosophy, that no one cared anymore. But things like these technological developments have highlighted the real value of philosophy. And I find that, and maybe this is the kinds of people I naturally meet, and there's a selection bias there, have a lot of interest and goodwill towards these topics in the first place. I haven't come across many people who were just fundamentally unmotivated to engage. But whether they really want to know about what philosophers actually do and have to say, rather than their idea of what philosophy might do or say, is a different matter. And I think that some ways of engaging them is to use compelling examples in particular, like really good case studies, things that get them really wondering and questioning. Those are really key. And then also to provide them with conceptual scaffolds. I think philosophy is particularly good at doing this, breaking things down and then systematizing them, providing taxonomies, providing distinctions, providing ways that then you can break up complex problems and think them through in a structural manner. And the other thing I think that philosophy can bring to the table is the fact that a lot of it is just about questioning the assumptions that you came into the room with. And it's fun to unpack that with people, to kind of say, okay, like this is your view now. What is it relying on? And what do we think about those assumptions when we bring them to light?
Isn't it disorienting? What sort of reactions do you get from your students?
It is often disorienting. I think that philosophy students come in kind of liking the feeling of being disoriented and disorienting others often. But yes. People who come from non-philosophy backgrounds can actually be quite upset by it. So I luckily do not have many people yell at me in my life or really get mad at me. But the times when I have, it's been challenging thought experiments, raising and challenging assumptions, and people can get very deeply upset. In one class, students of mine almost came to blows about some of the material. It was on topic, so I took it as an educational win in some ways. But it is very difficult to have the foundations of your worldviews challenged, and that's understandable.
I know what you mean. I had a student walk out of my session on the ethics of technology.
Wow. Yeah. I can't help but think, Claire, a previous colleague of yours, a guy by the name of Ludwig Wittgenstein, said that philosophy is nonsense. We're just wrapped up in language puzzles unnecessarily. Do you get students thinking the same thing?
Good question.
Not very often, no. I think most of my, I mean, again, there's selection bias, right? They've come into this course because they're convinced about the importance of ethical questions. Now, I should state that when we say ethical in my course, then this spans the entire normative or evaluative domains. That we're not talking about philosophical ethics, we're talking about morality, sure, but also the law, policy, epistemology, aesthetics, social norms, and more, anything evaluative. But I mean, has not academia and LLMs shown us the importance of language? Even if we think it's just language, then language is how we understand the world. Language is how we comprehend. And so I think that philosophy is very far from nonsense.
Or you could get all Derridian about it and say there's nothing outside the text. Boy, is there nothing outside the text, because that's all the LLMs know. So it works both ways, I'd say. Mm-hmm. Go on.
Now, I was going to say, could I sort of change gears a little bit and ask a little bit about you and your background? So what is your background, and how did you make the choice to become a professional philosopher?
So I'm not sure how honest I should be about the series of accidents that have led me to where I am, but I'm very grateful to be here. So I have done philosophy all the way down, so to speak. So I did pure philosophy here at Cambridge, in fact, my undergraduate degree and then my MPhil and my PhD. And my focus in my PhD was in ethics in particular. And then when I finished that, I really wanted to start focusing on questions of technology. I thought it was becoming really pressing, that it was disrupting, but also augmenting human experience. And that the heart of it all, the thing that really drives me, is the question of how do we act in the world? How ought we to be? And what kind of world do we want to build? And that requires us to have some ethical understanding. And so I did a series of postdocs. I had a lot of opportunity to do some really exciting research, but my passion has remained teaching. Wherever I've gone, no matter how voluntary it has been, I have ended up teaching, and I love it. I think that teaching teaches me an awful lot and guides a lot of the work that I do. It's a great privilege to work with such exceptional and capable students as I have got to teach.
And rewarding. So,
very, very rewarding indeed. And I have landed what I consider to be my dream job, where I get to do exciting interdisciplinary research that is respected for its interdisciplinarity rather than tolerated, while also getting to work with some phenomenal students.
Can I issue a jargon alert? Because I know one of your interests is in supererogation. Mm-hmm. What on earth is that?
So supererogation is a fancy Latin word for a very common everyday human experience, which is going above and beyond the call of duty. So I love this topic. This was the subject of my PhD, and I was drawn to it because ethicists love the dark, miserable side of our worlds. So academic philosophers, ethicists, love murderers and liars and thieves and promise breakers. They love promise breakers. And I thought, well, why are we always focusing on all the bad people when there is a lot of good in the world? And so I then wrote a very joyous PhD where I focused instead on the people who give blood and presents and save people from burning buildings, and the heroes, the saints, but also the really almost mundane everyday kindnesses that make up our world. And superirrigation is fascinating in part because, despite the fact it is cross-culturally robust as an experience, I haven't yet met anyone from around the world, and I ask everyone I meet, who doesn't have this concept, who doesn't have this idea. There are some things we have to do, and there are some things that are good to do, but we don't have to do them. Then no traditional normative ethical theory really makes room for this category of action. So the classical three in Western ethics are consequentialism, deontology, and virtue ethics. And on none of these theories on their own is there really space for this category of very common actions.
You missed out utilitarianism there. Is that something of interest to you? I think in effective...
I'll be consequentialist, no?
Yeah, well, I'm just thinking of the Oxford movement for effective altruism.
Oh, I see.
Yes, so I counted utilitarianism as part of consequentialism there, and essentially then there is no room for it, no.
Okay, so the connection with superirrigation and AI, say some more.
Well, initially, I honestly just wanted to move on to a new area of research. But interestingly, there has nevertheless been a crossover, and I actually have a paper in draft format, unpublished as yet, using supererogation to illustrate the ways in which machines fundamentally differ from us, and thus why their ethics must be fundamentally different from our own. And the case study that I use is how vital supererogation is to our to our everyday morality, and therefore why our morality is a bad model for machines for whom supererogation is simply inapplicable.
So we have to invent a new ethics, or we have to be super critical of our moral codes and our ethics to understand AI? What are the consequences of what you just said?
That we can't use us as the model, that these attempts to begin with our intuitions about what we ought to do, or that start with our behavior as something to replicate, are fundamentally misguided. And that instead we have to start with the machine systems themselves, their capacities, and the way in which we want the world to be, right? So most of ethics is really focused on our actions. How ought we to behave? And instead we have to transition a little bit to the idea of how do we want the world to be, and how can these systems with these specific set of capacities contribute to the realization of that goal?
Sounds like a giant reset button. Isn't a lot of art and literature understanding what it means to be human, which involves those ethical codes? You're saying maybe not.
Well, I think that art and fiction are incredibly rich places to begin when we explore machine ethics. I think there's a reason that science fiction has often been really interested in technology and this very speculative engagement where we can explore different kinds of futures, different ways of being, and challenge what we think it is to be human. And the modern technologies that we have right now were already doing some of that work in making us reconsider who we are, what we're interested in, and the kind of world that we want to build. I think that's why it's such an exciting area of research, is because those absolute foundational philosophical questions are things that are getting more pressing.
I got a question for you. How does that relate to management? Doesn't that imply that management deserves the same reset that Claire's just talked about?
Well, indeed, isn't this what we are trying to do here?
Yes, indeed.
And I think, I suppose, the question that I would kind of throw back at Claire then is, perhaps then literature and arts and humanities more broadly would be that bridge between these big questions and the practical professions that have come to almost pride themselves on being non-philosophical, exclusively empirical, like things like engineering or management. I mean, but is that the bridge? And also, I mean, I suppose if I could throw in a related question, what's your view on the kind of major misconceptions that people do have about philosophy and its role?
So, I do see that they are linked, because I think people often think that they're not relevant, like philosophy isn't relevant or the humanities isn't relevant.
Indeed.
Primarily because of the misconceptions that they have about what philosophy is and what it does. So some classic misconceptions are, the biggest one is that it's all just a matter of opinion. And that's absolutely patently not like just
so
not
pure true. Relativism. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So this is an idea that, you know, if everyone has an opinion on this, then a philosopher's opinion is just another opinion, and that's all there is to say. Now, it's not necessarily the case. Not necessarily. It's definitely not the case that philosophers have the answer to every question. We'd be out of a job. But there are always more interesting questions to be asked. But one thing that is true is that even when we don't know the right answer, we can know the wrong answer. And philosophy, I believe, definitely has made progress at illuminating some of the important contours and features of a problem space, but also have highlighted avenues that have been dead ends or are contradictory. It's also very good at revealing the costs of certain positions or certain kinds of actions in the case of ethics. And so I think that increasing public understanding of how philosophy can really reveal the assumptions and the foundations of the way we understand ourselves and the world around us will go some way to reversing that idea that it is just a matter of opinion.
So when you're interviewing students who want to come on your course, what are you looking for? If someone's watching this session, if someone's watching this thinking, how do I get all philosophical like Claire? What qualities are you looking for?
So two things to clarify. One is that we don't interview. We only have an application process. And two, then it's not about being philosophical. So it is, we really are looking for people from a wide range of disciplines here. But what we're looking for the course is at least enough background knowledge or demonstrable interest in the issues at the intersection of ethics, again, very broadly understood, and artificial intelligence data and algorithms to be able to flourish on this course. Some demonstrable academic abilities. Again, we know that you'd actually kind of thrive doing the kind of work that we do. And having an idea about what you really want to address here. So motivation on the one hand, and demonstrating the skills that you have to thrive in the kind of work that we're offering an opportunity to undertake. And really that passion that goes beyond the surface. So not being taken up by, you know, the headlines or the hype, but actually thinking then, well, what are the issues that underlie this? And how would we go about making progress in addressing those issues in particular?
So you have you're breeding is the wrong word, but you're developing a cadre almost of accidental philosophers. It would seem that's for professional schools, management schools. That sounds like not a bad idea.
Practical, maybe, rather than accidental. But sorry, yeah, I didn't mean to interject there.
That's all right. So I think it's hard to discuss these issues, almost any issue, without ending up asking some philosophical questions. But I might think that because I'm a philosopher. And
you would say that. We would say that.
Would say that, indeed. But I do think there's a value for almost anyone from my students who don't come from philosophy backgrounds, who end up writing non-philosophical research, but also management students and engineers and so on, being exposed to some philosophy because it is challenging. I mean, it specializes in critical self-reflection, and surely anyone could benefit from that. But at the same time, I should point out that there is a danger in the idea that then anyone is or anyone can be a philosopher. Philosophers also have deep levels of quite specific expertise, and actually then integrating not just philosophy into education programs, but also philosophers, I think is equally important.
Where's this leaving you?
Well, it leaves me with lots of questions about how we actually do this. How do we integrate philosophy into professional programs? So here on the MBA, for example, I just decided I'd try, a module, an elective module.
And it worked.
But it did work. And to me, this was a massive revelation that I tapped into a massive hunger for these big questions, and which I didn't realize was there. And it was great. But there's got to be a more intelligent way of integrating this into practical professions, like management, like engineering, like healthcare, maybe like medicine or jurisprudence. And what's your view, Claire?
So, I mean, it is a tricky one because obviously it's a whole discipline in and of itself, and I don't expect anyone to master it while also attempting to master another
exactly
degree. But I think some practical things that can be done is to break philosophy up, like break the contributions of philosophy up into content specific things, like the ideas and the kind of questions that occupy philosophers, the techniques that we use. And then also, I think a third thing would be like the virtues that we have, or the virtues that we think are important. I shouldn't actually say that we have them. Some people don't. It's hard, but we strive towards them, at least, shall we say. So there are focusing specifically on techniques, I think you can look at the fact that, like I was saying before, philosophers are really interested in challenging assumptions. So encouraging people from any discipline to say, okay, let's stop a minute and consider, what are the assumptions behind the kind of conversation we're having right now? And to take a step back from that and say, all right, we took these options to be the only options that there are, or these to be the costs. Why is that? Is there an alternative way of viewing this? What does the way in which we're engaging, or the way in which we're thinking about these things, tell us something interesting about ourselves? And are those things that we actually kind of, on reflection, believe are the most important, or the things that we would endorse upon self-reflection? And then there's also kind of the virtues that philosophers, I think, as I was saying, strive towards. And these include things like humility, the idea that we're not going to be necessarily Absolutely. Right about everything. We're going to have blind spots, and we have to be self-aware. But also things like curiosity, openness, that willingness to question the absolute fundamentals, I think, can be infuriating to a non-philosopher. But at the same time, I think it's one of our great strengths as a discipline, the fact that there's nothing that is off the table to be questioned. And that can be really revealing. That can really help to illuminate the foundations of any discussion. But I also think at the heart of many questions that people are interested in from a range of professional and academic backgrounds are at their base philosophical questions, and that philosophers have a lot to offer when it comes to thinking about this.
Isn't that dangling a kind of nice, shiny thing called transgression? And really, is there agency in transgression these days? I can't change algorithms. I can't change AI. I know you've written about what we should and shouldn't do with our data. Isn't that irresponsible?
To think about being transgressive?
Yes, but we can't be transgressive. Can we be transgressive with AI right now?
I'm not entirely sure in what domain you mean.
So can we say no? Can we say no? That's the wrong thing.
To what?
It's collecting the wrong data. It's the wrong answer.
Oh, I see.
I don't trust it. I can't be sufficiently skeptical. We should be doing something completely different. Is there really agency in that?
So there's two questions there. One is the saying, like the importance of saying it, and then the opportunity for doing something about it. And I think that highlighting the limitations of these things is really key. The imagining of alternative possibilities, the wondering, well, what would happen if we just said no to this entire technology, right? Facial recognition, lots of people asked for a moratorium on it. And that was an exploration of the idea of just saying, no, not right now. We need more time to think about it. But in terms of our agency to do something, I think one of the most difficult things about thinking of regulating technology at the moment is that the focus has been recently on individual action, and that is highly limited. And if you were thinking in a perhaps more conspiratorial way, you might think that was deliberate by big tech companies to say consent, that is all that matters. Right, so there's been one big model of regulating technologies is to say that we are simply going to ask people to consent or not consent. And that puts all of the onus of responsibility on individual users. And yet lots of research has shown that not only is that consent not very meaningful, you get all these pop-ups and you want to read something or do something internet, and you have to just click yes or no, or you know, and they make it really hard. You have to click all these different buttons and people tend not to do it. But also we're not well informed enough. So when we click consent, does anyone really understand what they're clicking yes to? For the most part, no. It's a lot of legalese, it's extremely long and tedious, it's very, very challenging. But also, a lot of research has shown it is almost entirely pointless. So lots of social media companies may well have data on you, even if you've said no, because other people have said yes, and they have data on you. But also, lots of things we're worried about are capacity-based. So you think about the models that are being built now and the things that they can do. Any one person's data is almost entirely meaningless to that model. We could remove that one person's data and the model would probably function just as well as it currently does. So does it really matter whether or not you say yes or no? And so I think a big part of the work that's being done at the moment is this move from saying it's an individual problem that has an individual solution to saying that this is a society-wide problem that requires society-wide solutions. Which is why I think there has been more impetus now on government regulation to attempt to provide that in a structural way and not rely on individual consumers. For example, at work might be required to use a certain software. Who gets to have consent then?
Well, I'm thinking of the pantomime villain of corporations that captures our data. Should we be saying no to them? Can we say no to them? They seem so big, they seem unstoppable.
So I think there's kind of good news and bad news. So one is sometimes I think that the story that gets told about the impossibility of regulating big tech is a little overblown. We have regulated successfully highly complex, very consequential industries. So I think aerospace is an interesting domain to consider. And I know that's, I think, of particular interest at Cranfield.
Yes,
absolutely.
Aerospace there. And think, yeah, like, look at the way in which planes and airlines operate all around the world. This is an extremely complicated system. There's no one person who understands everything that is going on in these systems. And yet somehow we have successful, for the most part, regulation. It's not perfect. There's been a lot of incidents recently, I think, that demonstrate some of the flaws in the system. And yet we don't throw up our hands and say, it's causally and practically too complex. Instead, we say this matters, therefore we're gonna regulate. The downside is that the kinds of technologies we're developing at the moment lend themselves to a certain kind of monopolization, and monopolies themselves are very hard to challenge. You might think some of it's too late, they're too powerful. The kind of extent and the wealth that are in these systems makes them a challenge. But that doesn't mean we should give up. And there have been lots of moves now, like lots of big players like the UK AI Safety Summit, the EU AI Act, and some of the interesting legislation coming out of the US, I think is providing some pushback on this now.
And I think that probably leads me to very nicely to a kind of big question that I wanted to ask you. And again, changing gears a little bit. Very general question. What do you think might be the most pressing issues in the ethics and philosophy of AI in the near future? I mean, is it about regulation? Is it about things like privacy? I mean, what do you think? What's right there on the horizon?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think maybe because of this year being one of so many key political elections, then it's going to be the impact of these untested systems in highly consequential geopolitical applications. So we could see a huge shift. So already we're seeing, for example, the use of deepfakes being used in political campaigning. So propaganda has always been around. That isn't new. But the combination that deepfakes have in terms of one being incredibly realistic. So having, now we can have voice generated, like voice replicated deepfakes, phone calls from politicians, like fake phone calls, that is incredibly powerful in terms of persuasion. But on the other hand, the big issue about deepfakes is they just muddy the water. That you cannot now tell what's true or false.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually more problematic in many ways. Not that you might believe something that was not true, that has been true for a really long time, maybe it's worse now, maybe it's not. But the fact that we are beginning to lose our ability to tell what is a real image and what is not is going to drive people away from having the knowledge required to have public discourse together.
So back to epistemology then, essentially.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We are going backwards in terms of our ability to tell what is correct. And actually that was the thing that we needed all along. Not true beliefs per se, but the ability to work out things in the world.
I'm interested in faith, but also the responsibility that education has to what you just said there. What does that mean, that education is different all of a sudden, or should be different?
Education is one of the domains I also think is going to is bearing the brunt of some of these technologies in terms of our inability to really predict how they're going to change things. So a lot of pressure has already arisen because the use of LLMs. Universities are beginning to wonder, is the ability to write an introduction or to polish up your language, is that a skill we think is essential? Or was it an essential part of the thing we really cared about in a world before LLMs, right? So can your students use them? What is education providing? What kinds of skills are students being are here to develop are all questions that the education system is going to have to grapple with now, and might be revolutionary. We have no idea.
It seems that we're moving away from the importance of writing to maybe reading or criticizing or curating. They seem to be a whole new skills in management as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, we have to then look at this interplay between the tragic loss of skills, a negative loss of skills, and a positive loss of skills. Mm. So I'll be the first to put my hand up and say, my handwriting is appalling.
I'd expect it to be, Claire.
But I don't have to do it anymore, right? Mm. And should we mourn the loss of handwriting skills so long as the technologies that we have where I type everything remain? Maybe not. But should we mourn the loss of people's ability to read and synthesize ideas?
Yes.
Well, maybe I'm old school. Maybe we'll look back at this in 20 to 50 years and think that was silly. Mm. We didn't need it. But at the moment, I think that that is intrinsically valuable and that we are eroding opportunities to do it. But doing that philosophical thing of taking one step back, why are people using these systems in education? Right? Why are students using them when perhaps we're told them not to? Well, one of the reasons is that the workplace has become so competitive. There is an idea about scarcity and the need to come out at the top of some sort of educational hierarchy to be competitive in the world that we're in. And maybe that's where we should start as the problem. Maybe it's not so bad that people lose these skills if only they were doing it for reasons that we thought were actually worthwhile, rather than I need to use an LLM to help write a draft of my essay because I need to do well, because I worry about not getting a job, because I worry about cost of living, and so on and so forth.
And of course, these motivations could be structurally determined as well. So could I then ask you about your current kind of interest? So we've talked about what you think might happen in the broad field here, but what's occupying you at the moment? What's on your intellectual radar screen? What books are on your desk? What are you reading and thinking about?
So most things on my desk at the moment are papers that I'm hoping
student
to
papers. Yeah, very good.
My open papers.
Okay.
So I have a bunch of research that I'm hoping to work on at the moment. So some of this is about deepfakes and the role that they have in the creation of pornography in particular, and how we might be able to find ways of addressing that. Some of it is about trust. So there's quite a contentious discussion about trust and machine systems. So one camp thinks it's impossible to trust things that are not human. Another camp thinks it's possible. And I want to look at why we ought to trust untrustworthy things. I'll leave it there as a little teaser, but hopefully that will come out in the near future. But I'm also very interested in design solutions. So a big move has been made at the moment to kind of democratize or have participatory design processes and include more people in that. And I want to in part look at the limitations of those things. So that's just a kind of a taster of some of the things I'm working on in the near future.
Wow. It sounds like you think your students, frankly, anyone watching this, could creep up on what you're talking about from literally any angle.
Exactly.
I'm thinking of art in particular, but it almost doesn't matter, right? There's an agnosticism to what you're talking about. Now, part of me thinks, as a philosopher, maybe that isn't right. And I'm going to go back to my point I mentioned earlier, faith. Faith seems to be an island where this doesn't apply. What are your thinkings about faith?
So actually, there's a research stream here at my center on faith and AI, and I'm hoping to somewhat revive it, to resurrect it, shall I say, because and it actually absolutely does apply. So in two directions. So on the one hand, the use of AI systems in faith-based environments, I think, is particularly interesting. So there's been some anecdotal stories about it being used to generate, like LLMs being used to generate sermons, but also, you know, how do we feel about robots in otherwise sacred spaces? I think there's lots of very interesting questions when we bring these two spheres together. But the other side of this is that faith-based language is one of the key ways in which we are describing and trying to comprehend technological systems. So this idea that technology might bring about the end times obviously draws heavily from certain kinds of traditions about the end of the world, but also talks of superintelligences and the idea that perhaps metaphors and narratives that are coming out of faith-based traditions are the way in which we should really be trying to explore and comprehend these things. So they, I think, are very much intertwined. Very much intertwined, and it would be an interesting space to explore further.
Wow, I'm fascinated by that. What it means to be in the world, that's astonishing.
So perhaps the last question that I have, kind of a more practical question for those who might be watching this this video. Back to the big question about the practical value of philosophy, whether it's in technology or more broadly. If there was one thing that you could recommend to someone watching this video that could help them really experience the practical value of philosophy for themselves, what would that be?
Oh, I mean, philosophy is a way of life. But I suppose if I had to give one piece of advice, it would be get speculative. See if you can stand outside of yourself for a minute, like pause in whatever you're doing and think, could this be done completely differently? Like, what are the underlying assumptions of this? What have I got caught up with assuming or taking to be necessary or taking to be important or valuable? And just taking a moment to question that. Because I think once we allow ourselves to be more imaginative, more curious, more open, to engage in this critical self-reflection that philosophy really tries to cultivate, we bring a lot of things to light about who we are and what we care about, but also what's possible. And without that, we can't make the world a better place.
I couldn't say anything else.
I got one last question. I think you know Halvard. I asked Halvard a random question, and I got one here for you. Andy Warhol or J.S. Bach?
Bach.
Because, yes.
Mainly, can I be honest and say maybe it's because I don't understand contemporary art as well as I should, but he speaks to me, and that's all I need when it comes to art.
The most abstract of arts. Amazing finish to an amazing interview.
Well, thank you very much, Claire, for your time and for your insights, for being so generous in sharing your ideas. I really enjoyed it.
Yes, I'm
sure
too.
Toby did as well.
I'm fired up. Claire, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's been really fun.
Thank you.